Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. Major crimes committed on the Wind River Indian Reservation end up in federal court. But federal courthouses in Wyoming are really far from the reservation, which leads to logistical, constitutional, and social problems. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Joroff reports.
John Crispin's son was murdered in 2011. He told me about it on a snowy night in the parking lot of a convenience store in Etherie, Wyoming, on the Wind River Indian Reservation.
Just right up the road a ways from here, just a little ways away from my home. There's a senseless murder. Well, it was 33 at the time.
It was a brutal crime, and because Wind River is a small, tight-knit community, Crispin knew his son's murderers. They were neighbors. The court proceedings took place in Lander, about 15 miles from Etherie. Crispin was able to attend along with some family. He says the two men's families were also there. About 5 months after his son's burial, tragedy struck again.
Truck flipped over. Well, my sister called me and said, you better go down the river to you. Your daughter's been truck wrecked. Said that truck was laying on its top. So I got down there. They said somebody got killed, and I didn't know. And I asked his aunt, she was crying. I said, who got killed?
His nephew was killed in the wreck, his daughter behind the wheel. She was charged with killing him. But the court proceedings took place in Cheyenne. That's about 300 miles from Etherie. Crispin couldn't make it down to Cheyenne for the trial or her sentencing. He says he didn't even know where she was sent to serve her time until she wrote him from prison.
It happens here. Why can't it be judged here? Why can't they just come and say, okay, can we just go to court right there so we can have be able to sit in, see what they're being charged with, and who's going to defend them, and so you can go over there and you can give them more support. Instead of way somewhere where you can't support them, you don't know where they're at, what's going on, until everything's already done and over with.
Crispin's questions bring up issues of justice services in Indian country. Serious crimes committed in Indian country that involve Native Americans as either victim or perpetrator go through the federal courts. About a quarter of the federal cases in Wyoming are from Indian country. Yet the cases are split between federal courthouses in Casper and Cheyenne, both hours from the reservation. U.S. Attorney for the District of Wyoming, Kip Crofts, says it wasn't always so. Lander used to have a courthouse.
Ironically, I was in a federal court hearing in that old courthouse when the new owner of the building, or lessee, whatever he was, came in and literally started measuring the curtains.
Its closing, which Croft says was basically the result of a terrible miscommunication, came just as other federal agencies opened offices near Wind River to better serve the reservation's population. The distance now brings logistical problems. For one, poverty on the reservation is high, which makes travel inherently difficult. Assistant U.S. Attorney Carrie Jacobson says often people lack reliable cars, public transport is practically non-existent, and a multi-day trip can be a financial hardship.
Although the government does pay a per diem and travel expenses in the form of gas money, or we can even pay a driver, we do not repair old vehicles. We do not pay for new tires for the long trip. There's no exception made for bad roads.
And it's not just the victims making the trip. Witnesses, law enforcement, and emergency room doctors are regularly subpoenaed to appear. And the government pays all of their expenses. That adds up. Then there's family, community members. Croft says he's even had to go pick up a client and her three young children up when they broke down in the middle of a snowstorm hours before trial. But there's an even bigger problem. Croft says venue rules explicitly state that court should be held where it's convenient for the parties.
Those kinds of crimes are community crimes. There are victims. There are victims' families. There are witnesses. There are defendants, defendants' families. And I think they need to be able to see those trials and see what happens. We snatch these people off the reservation and bring them down to Cheyenne, and nobody knows what happens sometimes. There's no sense of justice or restitution or all those issues.
And Jacobson says the jury that sits in judgment of Indian perpetrators rarely includes Indians.
It's tough feeling like we do have a jury of peers.
Jacobson says that's a problem because white juries often don't have a context for the crimes and the facts being presented to them.
So it really is like trying to present a whole new culture or society to 12 people who are living in just worlds apart. from the reservation.
A recent report by the Indian Law and Order Commission looked at this issue. Wyoming's Afi Ellis sat on the commission and notes they made some recommendations.
Our overarching recommendation would be for more tribal administration of justice at the local level.
That means giving more authority to tribes. Absent that, the report says the feds could at least move justice services closer to reservations or use magistrates to administer some of the services more locally. Crofts testified before the commission and agrees with its recommendations. He says already Native Americans see federal courts as foreign courts and mistrust them. In Wyoming, the state's federal judges are willing to schedule more local trials and try and fix the system. But barring the state's courtrooms, which also have busy dockets in the region, is not easy. John Crispin, for one, was disappointed with his experience. He says there's plenty of apathy on the reservation as is, and invisible justice just adds to it. Local trials would help, he says. Ellis will testify before the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs about the report next week. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhorov.
The common story behind the murder of Matthew Shepard is that he was targeted in Laramie's Fireside Bar because he was gay and was the victim of a robbery. Law enforcement authorities say Shepard was driven to the edge of Laramie and tied to a fence by Russell Henderson and Aaron McKinney. He was then pistol-whipped and left for dead. But for years, some say there was more to the crime than that, and author Steve Jimenez has explored those rumors. His book, called The Book of Matt, Hidden Truths About the Murder of Matthew Shepard, paints a different narrative.
What I believe is the truth is that Aaron McKinney and Matthew Shepard had a friendship for months before this crime took place. And that friendship involved, they socialized in the same meth party circle. They also bought and sold drugs from each other. And they did have an intimate personal relationship. To me, that alters considerably the understanding that was advanced by almost, you know, all of the leading news organizations in the country. And I'm including the New York Times, the Denver Post, the Boston Globe, Time Magazine, Newsweek, and many of the major television networks. And that story was that these fellows were strangers, that Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson walked into a bar and they targeted Matthew because he was gay. And the narrative quickly became that Matthew Shepard was attacked and beaten to death because he was gay.
Aaron McKinney, when he was interviewed by police, interviewed by you on a television program or that you were part of, he's denied ever knowing him.
Right. Well, first of all, Aaron McKinney has denied knowing him for a couple of reasons. One is that Aaron was at the time closeted bisexual. Aaron had a live-in girlfriend and a four-month-old child at the time. However, what persuaded me was when I began to have one on-the-record source after another, people that were able to place Aaron McKinney in very specific locations at specific times in which he was involved in gay activity. That's number one. Number two, Aaron McKinney had been dealing meth for 3 years prior to this crime. He was a meth addict. The people Aaron was dealing with are people that I've researched their backgrounds pretty carefully in terms of those who have ended up in the penitentiary, those who have, you know, in some cases continued to deal after this crime took place. So in Aaron McKinney's case, I think it's common procedure among criminals to protect people that are their accomplices. In this case, I think he was very careful about protecting people that were his suppliers. And so the fact that Aaron McKinney denied knowing Matthew Shepard is because that would have opened a can of worms that Aaron McKinney was not interested in doing.
But still, years later,
yes,
to continue to deny that, that just seems troubling to me.
It's not troubling to me at all, Bob. I've been investigating crime stories. I've been in state penitentiaries going back to the late 1970s. And if you know anything about the culture of prison, the worst and most offensive thing is to be labeled a snitch. And the people, again, that Aaron was dealing with, I'm familiar with their cases both on a state level and on a federal level for meth trafficking charges, very serious charges. For Aaron McKinney, then, to be identifying that is, to me, tantamount to asking for a tortured life in prison.
Matthew Shepard's involvement in meth, what leads you to believe that that's true?
Oh, numerous sources. I have, you know, interviewed on many occasions people that were inside the Matthews drug circle in Denver before he moved to Laramie. And he stayed in touch with the very same people when he moved to Laramie in the summer of 1998. You know, I could go on with other sources as well, but as far as the involvement of Matthew with methamphetamine, that's there. His good friend Alex Trout said that to police immediately after this crime happened. Matthew had gotten involved with cocaine and methamphetamine when he was living in Denver.
So what happened that night is, as far as you what's your belief on what happened?
What happened is there was a shipment of methamphetamine that was coming into Laramie. This was a regular shipment that part of it was delivered to Fort Collins. It was typically 12 ounces, and it was advanced by someone from the Denver Circle. On that night, Aaron McKinney believed that Matthew Shepard was bringing that shipment of into Laramie that night. Aaron McKinney had been following in Matthew's tracks that evening. So Matthew had spent a few hours at the library bar that afternoon. Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson showed up at the library bar first. They also then went looking at the old cowboy downtown and ultimately ended up at the fireside. But Aaron McKinney was following in Matthew's tracks that night.
And so that's why Matthew Shepard might have left with him, because he knew him.
Yes, he knew Aaron McKinney very well.
He gets killed because they want the meth?
Yes. Aaron McKinney was looking for the $10,000 of meth. It was 6 ounces. It had a street value of between $10,000 and $12,000. Aaron McKinney at that point, happens obviously on October 6th. Aaron McKinney owes, I've been able to, you know, trace a couple of his suppliers' money. This was Aaron's modus operandi. He was always falling behind. He was advanced meth, and then he was supposed to come back with the money, and he didn't do that. He was looking for the meth that night.
One last thing for you, Steve. You know, one of the things that has troubled people is that in some way you might be viewed as excusing this murder. Would you respond to that?
I don't think anyone that has read the book in any way could say that I'm excusing the murder. I have said repeatedly, I've said it in the book and I've said it in interviews, what happened to Matthew Shepard was a grotesquely violent murder. My interest here in looking at the complexities is to say, if we're serious about dealing with violence of this magnitude, and certainly in the state of Wyoming, which has had for years some of the highest per capita use of methamphetamine and some of the highest percentage of meth-related crimes, that it behooves us to understand this. We now know things about meth-induced psychosis, about meth-related violence, that we did not understand fully in 1998 when this crime happened. I did not write the book in order to prove that this wasn't a hate crime. Bob, it's easier to feel sad about what happened to Matthew Shepard, to stick with the legend and the myth. It's easier. That can also be an easy way out. I think it's harder. It requires more of us. It's more challenging, and it requires more courage to look at the complexities of this and really understand it. And for the sake of Matthew's humanity and what was lost, I think it's very, very, very important to look at those issues.
It's called The Book of Matt, Hidden Truths About the Murder of Matthew Shepard. Stephen Jimenez is the author. Nice to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Bob.
When we come back, we'll talk with an environmental law expert about a recent report regarding coal leases. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. The Government Accountability Office released a report earlier this week that outlined problems in the federal coal leasing system. The report called the Bureau of Land Management's process, quote, out of date, unquote.
The GAO's report said the BLM is inconsistent in how it determines fair market value, did not consistently document the rationale for accepting low bids, and did not use third-party review services to make sure its valuation was correct. It also said the BLM did not consider exports fully when calculating fair market value and lacked transparency about its process.
Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov spoke with Professor of Law at the University of Colorado, Mark Squillaci. He's been concerned for years that the BLM undervalues federal coal and says the American people are missing out on a lot of revenue because of it. That was Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov speaking with Mark Squillaci from the University of Colorado Law School.
One of the big issues the report highlighted was the BLM offices did not properly consider exports when calculating fair market value. Exports have gone up, but still make up quite a small portion of total production. So why is that part important?
The reason this whole issue is important is it's not enough just to look at the local market in the Powder River Basin, because we know that the market there tends to be with coal values at a much lower price. But when Powder River Basin coal is being sold in other countries or even in other parts of the country where the values are much higher, that ought to be taken into account in deciding what's a fair return to the federal government when the coal is being sold, let's say, in Appalachia for $50 or $60 a ton, even when, you know, the government might be getting, in its bonus bid at least, less than a dollar a ton for that coal. And so fair to ask whether or not there isn't some additional value that ought to be included. Now, in the export market, this becomes perhaps even a bigger issue just because of the amount that at least can sometimes be commanded in the international market for coal. Until recently, the price of coal in China was over $100 a ton. It's now dropped below that, but still it's a substantial amount of money. And again, the amount of profits that the company is making from that coal should be taken into account in deciding what's a fair return to the federal government. But I think the bigger issue is just that we're seeing an increase in the export market, and there's potential for a much greater increase if these export terminals are built in the near future. And so now's the time to sort of get a handle on this and try to make sure that there is a process in place to assure a fair return to the federal government.
Wyoming is the largest coal producer in the U.S. So what are the stakes for the state in having fair market value be properly assessed?
Yeah, I mean, the stakes for Wyoming are huge. State shares essentially equally with the federal government in the bonus payments and in the royalties that are paid on the production of federal coal. So there's a huge amount of money that comes into the state. The concern of the state ought to be whether or not they're getting their fair share. Let's just say that the coal in the Powder River Basin is selling with a bonus bid of a dollar a ton. If that bonus bid was instead $2 or even $3 a ton, then the bonus payments to Wyoming are going to triple.
Well, kind of a follow-up to that, states like Wyoming, which produce so much coal, weren't the ones actually pushing for this report and this information. It was Senator Edward Markey from Massachusetts. So why do you think the West hasn't been as engaged on the issue?
Well, that's been a real puzzle to me, and I have been interested in this issue for a long time, as you know. But I think it probably relates to the fact, first, that they're already getting a lot of money, so while my argument is that they could be getting much more money, potentially in the billions of additional dollars, the fact that they're already getting substantial revenues from this allows them to say that we are capturing a substantial amount of money. And I think there is an element of agency capture here, or the sort of notion that political scientists have that when you have a dominant kind of industry like coal, particularly one that is so important to the economy of the state, that they wield a great deal of influence in the politics of the state. And I think that has probably made it more difficult for the state to look critically at the way in which these valuation services are performed.
Mm-hmm. And I note that Senator Markey did some quick and dirty calculations and estimated that taxpayers are losing or have lost about $200 million in revenue. What do you make of that estimate?
Well, you know, my own view is that that's a very low estimate of the actual losses. I mean, in the Powder River Basin, they've sold almost 8 billion tons of coal over the 22 years of the study. And if the federal government had gotten an additional dollar per ton, which I think is totally realistic. Indeed, I would argue that they could probably get more than that. But let's just assume they got an additional dollar per ton for all that federal coal. That's almost $8 billion just for Wyoming and the feds to share in the bonus bid. So there's $4 billion on each side.
I wonder if you could just give a bit of historical perspective. In the 80s, there were concerns that the coal leasing program was also not properly valuing coal. The program was actually suspended while BLM went over that and tried to kind of amend its rules. Senator Markey is calling for a suspension of the current program. So did we just never quite fix it when we went over this in the 80s?
It really is amazing to me to sort of follow the trajectory of the federal coal leasing program. After the Mineral Leasing Act was passed in 1920, there was a lot of speculation in the coal industry. People were basically leasing tracts and not developing it. It was a big problem. Led to a moratorium in the early 70s, and that moratorium resulted in the passage of the reform law, the Federal Coal Leasing Amendments Act of 1975. That law was supposed to fix all these problems, and the government set about to adopt a set of regulations that could help deal with the problem. It led to the sort of failed sales that took place in the early 80s, another big set of problems, and you may recall that the government set up a commission called the Linaways Commission to investigate the sales that were done in the early 80s and try to figure out how to better reform the system. So a new set of regulations came out that helped to deal with the problems that were identified in those early sales. And that's essentially the set of regulations that we're operating under today. But the real irony, I suppose, of that whole story is that we have actually never used those regulations, because there's just one little rule in that set of regulations that says that all of this competitive leasing program doesn't apply if you're not in a coal production region. Now, there were originally 6 coal production regions in the United States, including the Powder River Basin. They have all been decertified, and since that time, the competitive leasing program that was supposed to apply under the regulations has essentially gone away. We simply allow companies to decide what they want, and the government just responds to it. There's no proactive administration of the coal leasing program, no real attempt, to my mind, to assure that the government is getting a fair return. And one value, I think, of the moratorium or suspension that Senator Markey is calling for is that we might just sort of take another look in light of the GAO report, in light of the Inspector General's report, and in light of the fact that there's a decline now in the coal market such that there really isn't a need for a lot of new coal leasing, at least not immediately, it gives us a chance, I think, to step back and ask whether we can't do better in terms of the leasing program and assuring fair return to the government.
All right. Well, Mark Scolacci, thank you so much.
All right. Take care, Irina.
When we come back, we'll hear about a PBS special about the life of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and we'll hear about the emerging sport of snowbiking. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. On Tuesday, the latest PBS American Experience will explore the lives of the famous Western outlaws, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Writer and director John Maggio looks closely into their lives.
You know, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid really were sort of the last of the great American Western outlaws. And they were being chased. They were being chased by a system that had been set up by railroad men, banking executives, the Pinkerton National Detective Agency. All these sort of forces of modernity were coming crashing down on Butch and Sundance and all the other outlaws that were out there at the time. And it was only a matter of time till they were sort of swept up and put in jail or killed.
They certainly spent some time in Wyoming, and I think that's why people have had an interest in both of them here. Let's start with the Sundance Kid. What did you learn about him that we've probably never heard before?
Well, his real name is Harry Longabaugh, and he was born in Pennsylvania. He was not a sort of product of the West. And what I think is beautiful about the Sundance Kid story is that when he was just a little boy, working in this kind of industrial world in Pennsylvania, he would read dime novels. He was like a lot of other kids in the East who would just you know, were so turned on by the West through reading dime novels and the stories of Wild Bill Hickok and Jesse James and all these great Western characters. So he was a voracious reader as a child, and he got his opportunity to actually go out West. He landed a job on an uncle's ranch out in Cortez, Colorado when he was about 14. So he was sort of drawn there through literature, which I think is a great part of the story and a great bit of information I actually didn't even know about the Sundance Kid. So when it wasn't until he was 14 that he actually got out West, learned to be a cowboy and a very good cowboy. And that's what started his life in the West.
Butch Cassidy spent a little time in Laramie. Tell us a little bit about him and what, again, we don't know about him.
Yeah, well, another incredible thing I learned about Butch Cassidy, his real name is Robert Leroy Parker, and he was born to a devout Mormon family. His mother was very devout. His family were some of the earliest Mormon settlers in Utah, which was a hard, hard life for them. The other thing I learned about, too, was he had met a man very early on when he had to sort of leave the ranch to make a little bit of money. He met a man with the last name Cassidy, who would eventually take his name from this guy. But this guy taught him the finer points of how to be a real outlaw cowboy, how to become a cattle rustler, how to kind of cheat and steal your way. That was not the sort of Mormon things he was learning through his family. So once he leaves Mormon country in Utah and goes to Telluride, Colorado, he's sort of set off on the sort of life of larceny with tips that he had picked up from Cassidy, the ranch hand that he met.
So they get together. How do they even meet?
Well, that's interesting. There's a lot of stories that, you know, they both were traveling cowboys for a long time. There was a horrible blizzard in 1886-87, which really was fundamentally changed the Sundance Kid's life. He was a wandering cowboy between Montana and Idaho and Wyoming, and this blizzard in 1886 just devastated. 90% of the livestock in that area were killed. I mean, many people went bankrupt, and a lot of cowboys were out of work and basically destitute. And people like Sundance turned to robbing. He tried to rob a train in Malta, Montana in the 1880s, and after that he sort of fled. He escaped. It was a failed robbery. They got about $8 each, and his two accomplices were arrested, and they ratted Sundance out, but he got away, and he traveled for a while, working kind of anonymously as a ranch hand, and he ended up going to Browns Park, which is sort of right at the corner of Utah and Colorado, and it was part of an area called the Outlaw Trail. And it was in Browns Park that he met Butch Cassidy, who himself had robbed a bank in Telluride, was on the run, but many outlaws, including Butch and Sundance, could hide in this area that ran basically from northern Montana all the way down to New Mexico. Now, they may have met earlier. It's unclear. They kind of knew some of the same people, but we sort of point to this point in time around in late 1880s that they probably would have met in Browns Park.
Bank robbers, supposedly spectacular train robbers, hear about trains blowing up and mm-hmm. things like that. Then of course they come across the Pinkertons and the chase scene we all hear about takes
yeah.
place.
I wish it would. You know what's amazing about, again, that most people's frame of reference is that chase scene in the Redford Newman film. It wasn't quite as concise. It was over a number of years that they were being tracked. But what is so different, I think, about the Redford Newman film and about the real story is that the Pinkertons, you know, while they did have many seasoned manhunters, like the kind they portray in the film, in the Hollywood film, they were much more sophisticated than that. They were keeping these detailed... The Pinkertons are sort of the embodiment of modernity in the West. They were keeping detailed files. They were using photography. They were able to trace serial numbers on banknotes that were being stolen by Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and their gang, the Wild Bunch. They were able to bring all these sort of modern methods of modern forensic detective work to bear on their chase of the Wild Bunch, Butch Cassidy, Sundance Kid, all the sort of last of these Wild West outlaws. And that's really what caught up to Butch and Sundance. Not so much them chasing them from town to town, but their ability to draw a large net over the West and kind of slowly close it around them.
they do go to Bolivia in real life?
They do. They actually flee to Argentina in the early 1900s, and a lot of the Wild Bunch members that were left behind eventually were killed or picked up by Pinkertons or Marshals or whomever. And it wasn't until about 1903 that the Pinkertons, who remained on the job sort of searching for them, the Pinkertons, remember, were employed by the bankers. They remained on the job, and they intercepted a letter that Sundance had written to his sister in Pennsylvania. And he had dated it and put a location of Cholula, Chubut, Argentina. So after that, the Pinkertons knew where they were. They sent word down. They sent posters down to Argentina. And local authorities went to arrest Butch and Sundance, and they fled. And they fled into Bolivia and then eventually went back onto the outlaw trail, so to speak, and started robbing mines down there. And then the local authorities finally caught up with them.
Are you one that believes they both were killed there?
I do. I do believe that. There's been enough inquest now into it that I do believe that not only were they killed there, but it was a murder-suicide. I mean, it seems by all accounts that Butch shot Sundance and then killed himself. They were just backed into a corner. There was just no more running they could do.
John Maggio, a pleasure having you on our program, and good luck with this.
Thanks so much, Bob. It was my pleasure.
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid is scheduled to be broadcast by Wyoming PBS at 8 o'clock on Tuesday night. You should check your local listings for other PBS affiliates in your area. If you've been out snowshoeing or cross-country skiing this winter, you may have noticed bicycle tire marks on the trails. That's because of a new sport called snow biking. It's gaining popularity fast, and cyclists and bike shops are thrilled. But some skiers feel the bikes present safety risks. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
It's a Saturday evening. Light snow is falling, and several dozen people are milling about at the Snowy Range ski area. They're bundled up with thick coats and hats, and they've brought their fat bikes. These are kind of like mountain bikes, only with really wide tires, designed for snow. Tonight, there's a race, the first snow bike race that's been held in southeast Wyoming.
3, 2, 1, go! Big lap!
Evan O'Toole organized the race. He says more and more people are snow biking these days, and with good reason.
Basically, if you live in Laramie and you like to ride your bike, it increases your riding time by 100%. Previously, you could only ride your mountain bike on trails for maybe 5 or 6 months out of the year.
Snow biking is a new sport. Fat bikes have only been commercially available for a few years. But Dewey Geigos, who owns the Pedal House Bike Shop in Laramie, says they're already starting to be a big deal. He expects to sell at least 8 or 10 fat bikes this year. And with price tags starting at $1,700, he says that helps his shop survive during the long Wyoming winters.
My first year, almost 2 years, winters were pretty rough. And it's not like they're easy cheesy now, because fat biking is not that huge of a sport, but it definitely fills some gaps.
But not everyone is enthusiastic. On a recent morning, Gallegos invited me to give snow biking a try.
All right.
It's slow going, but much smoother than mountain biking.
It's just so peaceful.
But toward the end of the ride, when our trail crosses a Nordic ski trail, a grooming machine approaches. It slows, and the groomer gives us a piercing stare. I later found out he was concerned because our bikes had left ruts on the groomed trails. He's not alone in that concern. Snow bikers have a hard time plowing through deep powder, so they tend to ride on trails that have been packed down by snowshoers or groomed ski trails. Christy Boggs is president of the Medicine Bow Nordic Association and coaches the UW ski team. She says when the snow is firmly packed on the trails, the snow bikes barely leave a trace. But under certain conditions, they can be a problem.
If it's fresh snow, then the snow bikes make ruts. You can get caught in one, kind of like a cattle guard or something, you know, and it can grab you and throw you off.
Boggs says neither she nor her team members have had problems with the bikers, but there have been some incidents.
I know of at least one really solid rec from somebody who really, really knows how to ski, you know, nationally ranked master skier.
Ski instructor Judy Holm has additional concerns.
If a bike was going the wrong direction on a trail, it would be difficult for a skier and a biker to avoid each other, and there could be some real safety concerns with that.
She says the stakes are higher if a skier collides with a biker as opposed to another skier.
Here you have a person who is just a person colliding with a piece of machinery that's steel, and snow bikes are heavy. They're maybe around 30 pounds.
Skier Larry Foyanini says the solution is simple.
I would just not like to see the fat bikes on the groomed trails.
Foyanini says he's not anti-bike. He and many other skiers are avid cyclists in the summertime.
And I think it's really cool that people are out there on bikes in the wintertime. But there's a place for them.
He and many other skiers think that place should be the snowshoe and backcountry trails, not groomed trails. But Christy Boggs with the Nordic Association and many in the biking community say they'd like to see a cooperative agreement rather than an all-out ban. Evan O'Toole, who organized the fat bike race, says snow bikers just need to be educated about how and when to use the groomed trails.
When used responsibly, the bikes don't have any impact on the trails, or no more impact than skis do.
O'Toole and the local bike shops are working to spread the word about trail etiquette, urging riders to avoid groomed trails when conditions are soft and to respect skiers. But tempers are still flaring. Online fat bike forums are filled with posts about skiers telling bikers to get off the trails. One cyclist even found a derogatory comment scrawled in the frost on his car window. The problems are not specific to Laramie. Nordic ski areas across the country are grappling with similar issues. Mike Van Abel is president of the International Mountain Bicycling Association.
There are some Nordic ski areas that are not willing to open up their trails to fat bikes, which is fine. And then there are others that are very willing to do so. In fact, I personally enjoyed a ride on Grand Targhee's groomed Nordic trail while people were skiing.
Van Abel says there's no single solution that works everywhere. But with fat bike sales doubling each year, he says it's important for users and land managers to sit down now and hammer out agreements for how to share the trails. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden. When we come back, we'll have a StoryCorps piece with noted Wyomingite Pete Simpson. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck. On Thursday, acclaimed author and speaker Deborah Fine will appear at the University of Wyoming Ballroom at 4:30 discussing the art of a conversation. Fine is a former engineer and the founder of the company called The Fine Art of Small Talk.
What are conversation skills that you use in order not only to look for a new career opportunity, but to also gain visibility in a community or leverage influence? And or just to not be a silo kind of corporate executive where you're in your office, you never leave it for lunch because you're so busy. But the truth is you just don't know what to say to those 25-year-olds that work for you.
Well, one of the things you suggest, like right off the bat, is prepare. I mean, be ready for
right.
a conversation.
That's right.
Would you talk a little bit about that?
If I'm going to go to a conference, an industry occasion, whatever it may be, I'm going to walk in prepared with things to talk about. So the obvious one is based on where we are, what we're attending, you know, what got you involved in this organization, what kinds of committees are you on and why, what did you think of that general session speaker? You know, anything that is a commonality for us, I might use that as an opening, but I'm prepared to do that. You know, my motto for me and anybody who wants to sort of change who they are as I did is be prepared with things to talk about. Be prepared with what to talk about when people ask you these rhetorical questions when you want to connect with people.
Deborah Fine visiting with us. I want to ask you about how one then uses a conversation to their advantage, or, you know, maybe it's job advancement or, you know, networking, that sort of thing. So we've talked about the initial introductions and how to engage someone. How do we take it to that next step?
Well, a couple of things. For instance, one of the roles that I'm serving at the University of Wyoming on February 13th is many of the attendees will be students. So one of their goals, I believe, I was a student once, I have children that are now self-supporting, I like to brag, but is to network with alum, as you know, as well as potential, but alum from the University of Wyoming. So how do you walk up to somebody like that, whether it's at the event on February 13th and or at a football game, or just at, or let's say you've met before, what do you say when you run into them again? This is a huge source of what they call networking. Most people think networking is reaching out and taking and asking for something when you need something. But that just burns bridges or just stalls. Instead, what I think networking should be is reaching out to people when you don't need them to build a community. So, for instance, if I were a freshman or a sophomore student at the University of Wyoming, I would be reaching out to alum now before I needed an internship, before I needed a position. If I was in finance at the University of Wyoming, I would be attending banking conference meetings, CPA finance monthly, you know, these monthly luncheon type things where you can go as a guest to meet people. And so networking is where you don't sit and just talk to the fellow student that's in attendance. Networking and talking to people is walking up to new people, introducing yourself and attempting to engage them in conversation and then building that network. But the other ways we use it is, for instance, I referred to it earlier, if you're a decision maker, if you're a manager, a leader within your organization, for you to not do sort of what they used to call management by walking around, but what now I would just call not being so busy at your desk that you build no rapport with the people that work for you, that the only time they engage in you is when during a job evaluation or when you're talking about a project. But instead you have to build that trust to actually walk up to somebody, say, so how, you know, bring me up to date. What's been going on in your life outside of work since the last time we talked? That's a very simple question to ask. It's pretty specific. It's not too personal. And it's a way to build a bond with somebody and get to know them outside of the business at hand. And that's the other reason conversation skills are so important. If you want to be an influencer, if you want to be the kind of leader people want to be around, you're the type of person that shows a genuine interest, not just when you need something.
Last point, last takeaway you'd like to give us.
Well, isn't that interesting? Did everybody hear, Bob, how he gave me an exit line? This is a wonderful technique to use for exiting people, and that's what I call a white flag. Bob, let me know, okay, this is it. You're almost done. So throw it out there. So that's what you're going to do at functions now. You're going to say, Bob, in a couple of minutes I need to take off because I've got a meeting I'm not prepared for. But before I do, Bob, tell me, what do you enjoy the most about your work with Wyoming Public Radio?
Mm-hmm.
So that is one of my favorite exit lines, is to wave that white flag. Let somebody know you can get out of this with dignity. However, let's go, wrap it up, we're done. You know, the person talking about their golf game for ad nauseum, et cetera.
Deborah Fine, we're looking forward to seeing you here in Laramie. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to being there.
Deborah Fine will speak at UW on Thursday, February 13th at 4:30 in the Union Ballroom.
This summer, StoryCorps set up a booth in Cheyenne to record Wyomingites interviewing one another and sharing their stories. Today, we hear from two members of one of Wyoming's most famous families. Millward Simpson, the grandson of former Governor and U.S. Senator Millward Simpson, interviews his father, Pete Simpson, a noted historian, educator, Republican nominee for governor, and former legislator. They begin their conversation talking about Pete's parents.
What's a vivid impression of your mom and dad, if you had to describe a still photograph that would really capture what your memory of your mom and dad were when you were a child, describe what that picture would look like.
My dad with a laugh, ready laugh, wonderful, gigantic personality. And mom looking gorgeous, gardening in the dirt, in Victory Gardens, you know, during World War II. Dad is, you know, full of, you know, the young volcano.
He's describing him as a volcano.
Yeah.
Right. My granddad and Nana loved to sing. What's a? Could you hum just a favorite song?
I'm actually going to do a kind of a favorite song thing for you because it comes instantly to memory. But, you know, we would sit in a car where you didn't have a heater, where they'd have hot bricks in the back and a wooden box that kept you warm and no radio. They would sing songs for 3, 4, 5 hours, never repeat a song, knew all the words, all of these, you know, making whoopee, all the Broadway tunes and what have you. They had gone to a musical show in Billings, Montana, where they came back singing one of the songs out of this play and went into Nate Natale's hotel, which had a series of mezzanines, and they went up to the top floor and were in a room, and unbeknownst was open, more open than they thought. And they were doing this little colloquy from the play, which was, "The night was made for love." And then the other one say, "No, no, no. The night was made for love. No, 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 no. The night was made for love." They did that. They did that about 4 times, and all of a sudden comes this big Italian voice says, "For Christ's sake, make up of your mind."
I can see Granddad getting a big kick out of that. Dad, you you come from a generation and have lived a life that has allowed you to be party to some of the most intense and consequential and transforming events in our country's history. I'm going to ask you to describe briefly what it felt like to live in Cody, Wyoming, during the Heart Mountain internment camp period.
I was 13 years old, and when Powell, the place between Powell and Cody, 12 miles from each town, was chosen for one of those internment camps, there was more than a ripple of fear, particularly when it was learned that there would be over 10,000 people there. Camp was a whole series of barracks on the most desolate piece of land you ever saw, Sagebrush Flats, shadowed by Heart Mountain, which became a symbol of this tragedy, which it was. It had barbed wire fences, unclimbable, 12-foot fences, I think that was the height, and guard towers with soldiers with their guns pointed in to where American citizens were. My first, I'll call this a gift of anomalous thinking, to really confront anomaly in life, was sitting in that Ford V8 coming out of there with Dad and looking out the back of the window at a guy in the Fifth Army with a 442 patch, which, of course, was the most decorated battalion in the war, kissing goodbye to his girl underneath a guard tower with soldiers pointing their guns at, obviously, the place where his family lived. That was a new kind of political thinking. Independent thoughts. What is this? This is somehow
that is not right. Incredible.
That was Pete Simpson with some memories of the past. He was interviewed by his son, Millward. The piece was produced by Bob Beck with interviews recorded at StoryCorps, a national nonprofit whose mission is to provide Americans of all backgrounds and beliefs with the opportunity to record, share, and preserve the stories of our lives.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and less important information, you can follow us all on Twitter.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.